End today by thanking a couple of people for the things that you can see and touch with regard to the classes, and at least in particular to things you can see and touch that have reference to the class I'm teaching. First of all, thanks to David Norris for putting together the material that's in the notebook with reference to my class, the printed material. I think there's probably about a page for each day there. I haven't actually looked through it. And I don't know precisely what it is, but he culled that out of some things that I sent over. So I appreciate that very much, and that may be helpful to you as we talk. I don't know if the pages are numbered, but it's in there somewhere. You can find it if you want it. And also thanks to David Sims, whom we're getting to know better by the minute as well, for preparing the things that you're going to see up here on the wall. I don't know how much time he's put into this, but I know it must be a tremendous amount. And I didn't get the material to him in a very timely fashion at all, and yet he did whatever it took and pulled out all the stops, even in the face of the death of his grandfather. And I appreciate very much, against the odds, him coming up with what he has. And when you see some of the things he's done, some things I had intended just to have up for a second, I feel like I should leave a while so you can view them, because they must have taken a great deal of time. And it wasn't just him. You know, I've only known Dave for about a day, but I think I already know something about him. Perfectionists are people who not only take great pains, but they also give them to others. And so he had some other people working on this. His aunt drew at least one or two pictures, and they're things that were non-essential. I already know if I was doing, I haven't ever been involved in this before. If I was doing it over, I would already do several things differently. But I just wanted to say thank you very much. I thought it should be said publicly. Thank you for all that's been done there. Whatever you see on the wall, Dave has put together out of the hen scratchings that I sent him, and probably too hurriedly put together for him. So I think that needed to be said to both the Daves. Thanks for bearing with my schedule. I think they didn't get the last stuff until last Thursday. And also, in addition to thanking both of them for their wonderful job, I'd like to thank them for so politely bearing with my personal Neanderthal tendencies where computers are concerned. I don't recall having done this before, but I can see a great deal of value in it. I think it is a good thing. And it's a little bit more complicated than what I'm used to. I'm not used to having to be ready with everything. I mean, what I mean is ordinarily, that isn't what I mean. Maybe it is what I mean. I mean, I can be ready, but still, when the class comes, it's the thoughts that I have right then. But now, it'll be the thoughts I have right now and the thoughts I have then at the time. And I don't know how those are going to coalesce. So I just wanted to warn you. It reminds me, since you're with me, keep you with me at least through an intro here. It reminds me of a time my wife and I were singing at a wedding together. And we were singing, they wanted a four-part harmony, and we could only do a duet live. So we recorded, I believe this is the way it was, we recorded the two parts that we weren't going to sing live. And then we played that on one of those old reel-to-reel recorders. And as we were singing this during the wedding in front of the assemblage that looked a lot like this one, we noticed that this tape was coming out of its slot, and it was increasing the speed of the tape so that the song was going faster. And our only options were to either just stop the tape or to go into a chipmunk voice to try to stay up. And this kind of reminds me of the same setting in a way, because this is something as I prepared ahead, and this is going on live at the same time. So I don't know how sure I am about the coalescence here, but I don't intend to make that announcement every day. You'll be aware. Be aware of what's going on. And I appreciate your bearing with that. Now, I'd like for any of you who choose to ask or say anything as we go along through the classes together. I think it works better that way. This is not a speech at least not intended to be one. So if you have something to ask or say, I still believe, after trying it all different kinds of ways, that when a question originally occurs to you is probably the best time to ask it. So if you choose to do that, that'll be just fine as we go along. The subject that has been assigned to me, as has already been said, is God is awesome. When Janice called, because she was the one from the committee that determined these subjects, who called me and informed me about it, when she told me what my assignment was, the first thing I thought of, I'm almost already, almost forgetting already to do this. The first scripture that I thought of was the 111th Psalm, and you can easily imagine why. Verse 9, holy and reverend is his name. Now the word reverend is applied to God only in the Bible. Reverend comes from the word yare, a Hebrew word. And somebody asked me, I think it was Dave yesterday as we were reviewing this. By the way, he also taught me everything I know about this, and he even taught me how to go backward. The first six times I asked him if I could go backward, it was no. But what I found out what that meant was that I can't go backward. He can go backward. He finally taught me how to go backward. So if you need to go back, I know how to even do that. You don't believe it? Just test me. But he asked me how you pronounce that word. I said the way I pronounce it is yare. I don't know how you pronounce it. Probably there's an extra breath of air there. But we're not concerned with the pronunciations. I'm just interested in this word from the standpoint of its meaning, and it means awe-inspiring. Why the word reverend began to be applied to individuals that are theological professionals, I'm not sure. I can only guess at that. But I'm absolutely certain that it wasn't God's idea. This word yare, that means awe-inspiring, in the New International Version is translated as awesome. Holy and awesome is his name. And as Dave Norris was pointing out yesterday, this doesn't have anything to do with the current slang usage of the expression awesome. I was out here in 1964. We were staying with some people up in Apple Valley during the height of the surfing craze. And there were two words at that time used to describe waves. One was tubular and the other was awesome. And then lately we've had a kind of a resurgence of this sort of an expression. So we don't want to get confused here in what we're saying. This was in the Bible a long time before current vernacular came about. I'm not saying the current vernacular is problematic. I'm just saying we want to be sure we understand the seriousness and the sobriety of what's involved here. Holy and awesome is his name. And I have wondered if instead of calling these people reverend, people began to call them awesome. Could they handle that? Could they stomach that? I just wonder. Instead of the Reverend Mr. Jones, if this were the awesome Mr. Jones, how would that go over? The audacity of man that's involved here. You just don't know what to think about it sometimes. Everybody that's done funerals has had the experience of looking at the funeral notice and there's a reverend in front of your name. And it just makes you sort of have a sick feeling in the pit of your stomach. You don't know whether to do like Paul and Barnabas did and say no, or what can you really do about it? But how did this ever begin? Who would ever have this idea in the first place? The audacity of man, the pretentious pomposity of the human personality that has led us down all sorts of wrong paths is involved in this. I don't think, surely, that people would have the audacity to be introduced as the awesome Mr. Jones, but they're saying basically the same thing. Something is happening here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? Not if you would accept that kind of a title. What's happening, Dave? Okay. Thank you. As I said, it has led us down all sorts of humanistic type of attitudes. Somebody was reading out of the Roman letter a little while ago. They worshipped and served the creature more than the creator. They did not like to retain God in their knowledge. A number of statements there apply to this idea. Alexander Pope wrote these lines that you see on the wall. Know then thyself, presume not God to scan. The proper study of mankind is man. You can't tell it completely from that popular citation. But the idea here was that we were to be interested in things that are human. We can't know anything about God anyway, if we believe in a God. Now, Alexander Pope had a very severe physical deformity, had a curvature of the spine that only allowed him to stand up to about 3.5 or 4 feet high, and had reached a stage of cynicism that most of us could only, I won't say dream of, but he was a very embittered man by his physical disabilities. And that may have had a lot to do with some of the things that he wrote. He may have believed in God, but if he did, he was mad at him. And so he said, human beings should be our study. And this is what our world in general tends to believe today. The human body, how to care for it. The human mind, how to educate it. Human philosophy, human achievement. Anthropology, the study of man. Under humanism, man plays God until he becomes his own God. And that's the situation we have now. Now contrast that with the words of Solomon in Ecclesiastes when he said that God is in heaven and thou upon the earth, therefore let thy words be few. That ought to make us sit up and take notice. Let thy words be few. That we're dealing with a personality here who is so tremendously awesome that that overused word doesn't really catch it, although we can't think of any better words either. And we ought to be very careful about what we say, especially with reference to him and to things that he is involved in. Therefore, let thy words be few. Now, it's already been pointed out that we can learn some things about God from the natural world. The Roman letter chapter 1 makes this quite clear, as well as other portions of the Bible. We can see the order of God, for instance, by looking at the created universe. And I appreciated what was said about John Clayton and the work that he has done, especially with regard to creation. He's one of hundreds of people that I myself have not only listened to, but actually borrow materials from, which is about the best compliment you can pay somebody, I guess, is to steal their stuff. So I wanted to say that as well. We start by talking about God in his spiritual nature. John 4:24, very familiar passage. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. I don't intend to talk very much about the evidences for the existence of God, if at all. When I was originally assigned this, it was indicated that Charles was going to deal with evidence, and I didn't know what area of evidence, so I thought I'd just leave that whole area alone. And so I think maybe Doug tonight possibly is going to deal with some of that type of thing as well anyway. But there are whole areas here that are available for exploration, and you don't need to be afraid that you're going to learn too much or you'll learn something that will lead you away from God, as long as you look at all the evidence that's available. The starting place in considering the awesome God is by recognizing his spiritual nature. And a lot of the arguments against the existence of God are rooted in fundamental misunderstandings about what God is, what his nature is. A lot of people have ideas about God that are, as we say, anthropomorphic. In other words, they are like man. And we tend, even though we don't mean to sometimes, to actually create God in our own image and after our likeness to make him like us. The Bible explicitly said that God is not a man. Still, and said that in more than one place, still, it's easy to make him like a man. Almost all of our information about God comes from the Bible, his word. And if we read it, study it, then we won't need so much to be asking questions like so many people ask in the world. I hear people in the world asking what color skin God has, or things like how can God hear my prayer and the prayer of somebody in China at the same time? Or how do we know that God hasn't died since he created the world? These kinds of things, which if we look at what he says about himself in his book, what happened now?
I have no idea.
Oh. Well, I'll help you with it later, Dave. You are running out of space. Thanks. Believe me, I'd like to. All right. A lot of these things that I was talking about just demonstrate our basic ignorance about God and his nature. And since we were talking about Dave, I have to make an apology to him publicly, because this picture, I didn't give him enough information about what I wanted here. I really should have just left this off, but since somebody has gone to a terrible amount of trouble to make the picture, I'll leave it up there for a while and talk about it a bit. This was that wall was supposed to be like an enclosure, but I didn't tell anybody that. And it also should have been a higher wall, because the story, and this is supposed to be a true story, you may have heard this. There was this professor that was on his way to an appointment at a town a few miles away. And he blew a tire just as he was going by what we used to call an insane asylum. I'm not sure what they call them now. They change names every few years. But we used to call them insane asylums, and there was this big wall around it as he got ready to change his tire. He said, "This won't be any problem. I've got a few extra minutes. I'll just change it." So he got in his trunk and got his spare out, jacked up his car, and took the lug nuts off the offending wheel and put them down on the ground. And as he was maneuvering around out in this rural area, he took the tire off and put the new one on, but his foot kicked against those lug nuts and sent him down a gopher hole. And they went all the way down. He could hear them chinkling as they went down the hole. No possible way in that parched area of recovering those lug nuts. And so he thought, "Oh man, I'm going to be late. What am I going to do?" And just then he looked up and he saw this guy sitting up high on the wall that was supposed to restrain him. He's obviously an inmate of the asylum. And the guy in the asylum said, "What are you doing?" And the professor said, "Well, I'm trying to change my tire, but now I've lost my lug nuts and I don't know what I'm going to do. I guess, I'm sure you don't have anything to help me with. I guess I'll probably just have to walk to the town, and I'm going to be late for my appointment." And the guy sitting up on the wall said, "Well, why don't you just take one lug nut off each of your other three wheels? That'll give you three, and if you go slow, you ought to be able to make it into town just fine." And the professor said, "That's a wonderful idea. Why didn't I think of that? What are you doing in that asylum anyway?" And the man on the wall said, "Well, I'm crazy, all right, but I'm not stupid." And this points up the way we use these kinds of expressions. There is a difference between crazy and stupid, and there's a difference between ignorant and crazy and stupid. We are all ignorant about God. You're all right. Yeah. We're all ignorant about God, but we have to recognize not to presume beyond what we know. We just have to understand that we do have this uninformed area where God is concerned. It may be that God didn't have any choice there, because he can only communicate with us in a certain way. He has to use our language to do that, pretty much. It's kind of like Roger trying to talk to us, as he was yesterday and did an amazingly fine job. But yet he has to use this limited means of the English language, which must seem very cumbersome to him. He has to use that because that's the only way he can communicate with us. Most places he goes, most of the time he doesn't have to be bothered with that. But to communicate to us, he does. It's an experience that most of us will not have, to try to deal with that kind of a situation. And it must be the experience that God has in trying to relate to us as well. So that brings me to the place where I just wanted to deal with the concept of flatland as expressed by Edward Abbott, who was a 19th century mathematician. One time I had a copy of his book, but I've loaned it to one of my brethren, I guess. I don't know who's got it. But I can remember the gist of what it said. It was about a man, or the idea was that this man lived in a two-dimensional world. It's like a sheet of paper. It just had the width and the length, but it didn't have the breadth. There is a little bit of breadth there to the sheet of paper, but forget about that. We're just talking about the surface of the sheet of paper. And this man lived in the surface of this sheet of paper, just in a two-dimensional world. Now, by contrast to that, I am a three-dimensional being. I've got length and I've got width, and every year I have a little bit more thickness this way as well. So I'm three dimensions, and you can't get me into that sheet of paper. You can take a picture of me, and from the front view, from the side view, from the back view, from the top view, if you can stand the glare. But you still can't get me altogether into that piece of paper. And that's the idea of the difference in these dimensions here. Very important concept. You can't translate three dimensions into a two-dimensional sheet of paper. So getting back to the man in Flatland, he's living there in his sheet of paper, sitting in his living room, and he's visited by a sphere. Now, a sphere, of course, is a ball. We all know what this is. He's visited by this sphere that comes down into his living room, just touches there. And so there's a dot that appears on the floor of his living room. And the sphere begins to pass through the plane of Flatland. And so the dot then becomes a circle, and the circle begins to get larger and larger on the floor of that man's living room as it approaches its equator. And the man doesn't know how big the circle is going to get. It's very confusing to him because in his little two-dimensional world, a law of science has been broken. Matter has been created, and that's not supposed to happen. Matter energy cannot be created or destroyed in this closed system that we're living in. And so he's confused about what's happening, but this circle is getting bigger and bigger, about to run him out of his house when suddenly it passes its equator, and then the circle begins to get smaller and smaller until it becomes a dot again and disappears, leaving him thinking, now how can matter disappear? That's against the laws of nature too. So the next time this happens, he starts up a conversation with the sphere, and he says, what's it like to be a sphere? And the sphere says to him, well, that's simple. Just draw a circle on your floor over there. Well, that's not easy to do in Flatland because you have to push the pencil along. The man in Flatland himself is just a series of connected dots. That's what makes a line. And he has to push the pencil along because there's no third dimension, remember. So he finally draws this series of dots that come back and meet itself. That's the definition of a circle in Flatland. And when he gets that done, the sphere says, all right, now rotate that circle. And so he rotates the circle around this way. No, go the other way. So he rotates the circle around this way. No, go the third way. He wants him to go like that. But the man in Flatland said, what do you mean, third way? There is no third way. Because he's living in a two-dimensional world. And the problem that we have is that we're here in this three-dimensional world, and there are other dimensions beyond what we understand. And we have a square peg round hole problem here. Every time we attempt it, so many of our discussions about heaven and hell are thwarted by this every time we have them, and lots of other subjects as well, because it's a square peg round hole problem. We just don't, any of us, really understand what we're talking about. All we know is what the Lord has revealed to us in human language. That's the problem that we have. Let's see, where am I on this? Okay, these are the descriptions, some of the descriptions that the Bible gives us about God. The Bible gives us these descriptions about God to try to help us understand what God is like, and that's what we're talking about today. This awesome God, what is he like? We can only understand this three-dimensional world, but God has more dimensions than that. We don't even know how many dimensions he has. So the man in Flatland is us, and that's why we don't grasp subjects like this very well. We don't live in a sheet of paper, but we live in a three-dimensional world, and there are other dimensions higher than our own. My point here is that we're not talking in this class about a God that's made out of gold or silver, graven by art and man's device. That's what the people in Athens were used to thinking about, and they weren't stupid. They were ignorant, though. They were worshiping a God that they didn't know, and they admitted that they didn't know this God. They had an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. They were just ignorant about him. And Paul said, I've come to identify the unknown God for you, and they took him up to the highest court to hear what that was all about. Acts 17:30, not gold or silver or stone graven by art or man's device. We're talking about a God who is just infinitely superior to that. He has a similar relation to us as the sphere had to the man in Flatland. And I think that may help us to grasp that concept a little bit. Now, these descriptions, not flesh and blood, love, spirit, light, unseen, not a man, eternal, unchanging, all tell us about different aspects of God. That he is eternal and unseen, he is non-physical, and really he's non-anthropomorphic because it says, not like man. But we also have the Bible talking about characteristics of God in which it sounds like he must be similar to man. We have references many times to the face of God, or to the hand of God, the finger of God, the arm of God. So how do those fit into this? I have a personal conviction about that, that you don't have to agree with. But I believe that these do not refer to what God is so much as they are descriptions of how God does things. And we do the same thing in terminology otherwise. For instance, when we talk about the long arm of the law, we don't mean that literally, and nobody would take it in a literal way. That if you're going along Interstate 91 and you speed, that a big arm and hand comes down and picks your car up so you can't go anymore. We don't think of it that way. That's not what we mean when we talk about the long arm of the law, even though we use this expression. I believe the Bible uses expressions like this referring to God in a similar way in order to show us how God does things, because God is limited to trying to use these kinds of illustrations to describe it so that we can understand it as best we can while we're here. We talk about the face of America, meaning the average American, what he thinks and does and what his value system is and so forth. The Bible uses anthropomorphic, accommodative language when describing how God does things because we still live in flatland. If it told us precisely how God does things, it wouldn't be a revelation anyway, because we wouldn't understand it. We couldn't possibly be communicated to by that. So the Bible has to use our words when communicating to us, just as Roger has to use our words when communicating to us. And it's quite a handicap for God or for Roger. They both do amazingly well at that. Now, some people think that it's possible that time is the fourth dimension, and I wouldn't know how to argue that one way or the other. Go ahead, Lynn. Thank you. I know how. How far you want to go? Oh, wait a minute. You showed me on the other computer. Page up, right? Okay, where do you want to go, Glenn? Thanks, Dave.
Just the one before that, the characteristics of God.
Before that? When was that?
I'm drawing a blank myself.
We'll draw it up there. Well, yeah, we need it. That one?
Yeah, okay.
Thanks. Thanks, everybody. I know.
Oh,
it's just the first day.
I want to throw into your comments.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to contradict them.
Okay.
Moses had seen the backside of
right.
God, correct?
Right. The receding glory of God.
And we're made in the image.
My personal conviction about being made in the image of God is that it is his image spiritually rather than physically. That's my personal view of it. I don't think that's something we have to agree on, but I have problems if we're physically made in the image of God. How come we don't all look precisely the same and so on and so forth? But anybody feel free to disagree with that, because there can be a case made on the other side of it. Did you want to say any more about it? Or okay. Anybody else want to comment on that or anything else? All right. Appreciate it. Glenn, thank you very much. If we can understand these properties of God as the Bible gives them to us, then we can answer some of the questions about what God is like, which is what we're attempting to do. And I think it's good to talk about time a little bit with reference to this, because the Bible gives us tools to talk about the properties of God and his nature. And I think one of the ways it does this is with the area of time. I'm not sure. I did find my list of these things. Let me see what's next here. I just had it up there. Oh, okay. Let's go two things. There, that's the verse I'm looking for. 2 Peter 3:8. One day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. This shows that time is not the constant with God that it appears to be with us. And it's just been during the 20th century that we begin to play with this idea a little bit, that time is more elastic than we had previously thought. The Bible teaches us that time had a beginning, it's going to have an end. That's something that a lot of people don't believe, but that's what the Bible tells us. I visualize time just like I visualize that wall over there. I should say I think God visualizes time like we can visualize that wall. God can see the beginning of time. He can see the end of time. God can go and touch any point of time, just as we can go touch any point on the wall. God doesn't always choose to do that, just as I'm not now choosing to go touch the wall. But I believe that David killing Goliath is before the mind of God now, just exactly like us sitting here is before the mind of God now. These are all open and available to him. He's not limited. And that's why there's such a thing as prophecy and history. These are distinctions we make for our purposes, depending on where we are in time. There used to be a lot more prophecy. Now there's a lot more history because we're a lot further along in time than we were before. And so prophecy, a predictive prophecy, is just history before it happens. And history is just, if it had been predicted previously, is just prophecy that's already transpired. It's really all the same to God. Never in the Bible made any difference to him whether something had already happened or not. He knew what it was, or at least the information was available to him. Sometimes he seems to have limited himself purposefully for certain reasons so that he might not know something, but it wasn't because he couldn't have known it. He walled it off from himself for a certain reason, perhaps. He even knew what would happen but wouldn't happen, what could happen but wouldn't happen. You know what I'm talking about? It's kind of hard to describe that. But David one time asked the Lord, if I do a certain thing, then is somebody else going to do a certain thing? And the Lord said yes, and so David never did the certain thing that would have precipitated the other thing. The Lord not only knows what is going to happen, but he knows what would happen if we made different decisions. A mind magnificently great and universal enough to do this is beyond our comprehending, but he's capable of this. So he's got this ability where time is concerned. And this verse talks about the elasticity of time. I wanted to talk about that a little bit as well. It used to be thought that time wasn't that way, that you can't speed it up or slow it down or change it, that it just flows along in one ethereal substance for all things. And then in this century, we started talking about equations like that. Now, I'm not going to ask you to do math, and this is probably going to be the only day I'm going to put anything like that up there. I'm not asking you to do math, just to look at math for a minute. It's Einstein's equation that has to do with time, where t equals the time that you experience, and t sub zero is the time you would experience if you were not moving. You may not feel like you're moving, but you're going on the surface of the Earth along through space about 1,000,000 miles an hour right now. So you are moving. T sub zero is the time you would experience if you were not moving. And V up there is the speed that you are moving, and C is the velocity of light. So although it looks complicated, it's really a pretty straightforward equation. And we're not going to do anything with it except just to notice it. And I want to notice Einstein's description, intuitive description of what this equation shows. Since you've got the speed of light down here in the denominator, obviously, I keep forgetting I can leave over there. Here's the speed of light here. The more you approach the speed of light, the faster you go, then the bigger this all gets to one, and the bigger the whole thing, the time that you're experiencing becomes, because it's not divided by as much. You see what I mean there? And so Einstein talked about the twin paradox, which I think probably most of you are familiar with, but I just want to run it by you again. He used this illustration himself many times. But you take identical twins that are 10 years old. One of them stays on Earth. The other one goes into a spaceship. And just look what Dave has done here. It's just, I mean, this is what I sent him right here. And who knows how long he had to search for this. So we got the space shuttle taking off into space with one of the 10-year-old twins. And it's going to the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, 4.3 light years away. Goes there and comes back, another 4.3 light years. And so he's gone for 9 years. And when he gets back, of course, the Earthbound twin is 19 years of age. And he walks up to the space shuttle as it lands, expecting to meet a brother that's somewhat equivalent to him, but out steps a 10-year-old kid that's just exactly like he was when he left. All he had to take was a sack lunch because time slowed down so much for him because he was going at the speed of light. Now, it's not possible for us to do that, but this is just theoretical. And this is the way, assumingly, that it would be if this occurred. The point is that time isn't always experienced the same everywhere. And just in our century have we for the first time really been able to grasp that concept is true. Time wouldn't have passed for that boy in the spaceship while he was going at the speed of light. So his heart would have slowed down because time was dilated for him, so he would not have aged. His digestive system would have gone at a slower rate. That's why he only had to take one lunch with him while his brother was experiencing 9 years of life here on the Earth. So time changed for the boy in the spaceship. And what that says is that this description of time in 2 Peter 3:8 is totally consistent with the nature of time itself. That's the kind of stuff that time is. It can speed up, it can slow down, even mortal man can manipulate it. We've got atomic clocks. We've seen now that gravity distorts time. Until we could measure it real well, we couldn't know this. But you take, for instance, the atomic clock over at Boulder, Colorado, which is about a mile high, and the one at Greenwich, England, which is about sea level, and they don't move at the same rate of speed because they're not experiencing the same gravity, they're not at the same altitude, and over the course of a year or so, they get off from each other and have to be reset. Or you can put a cesium clock in an airplane and take off with it real quickly, and we've learned that gravity distorts time, and speed distorts time. Now, this may have all sorts of other implications, but I don't want to go into any of that, at least not right now. I'm not capable of going into it. But I just wanted to set that idea as simply as we can before our eyes. And we know that space and time are inseparably linked. They're really seemingly functions one of another. Dean, go ahead.
So what you're saying is that, let's say 50 years ago, we didn't have as much knowledge of time as we do today.
Yes.
And we're nowhere near understanding God and
right.
His relationship with time.
Right. And we've also learned that time is not a constant. And the Bible has always said that to God it's not a constant. I mean, there's fluctuation there. At least that's a part of what I understand 2 Peter 3:8. I think there's more in 2 Peter 3:8 than that, obviously. But I think that's a part of what we are probably intended to understand from that, but didn't understand as well until our own time. If you could wave a wand right now and stop time while you continue to function as you are. Now again, it's not possible, but just assume for a minute that you can wave a wand right now while you're sitting over here in the Los Angeles area, and you can still continue to function as you are. Maybe I'm not supposed to step in front of that. That's not... Now, laser pointers, that's kind of dangerous, isn't it? That's what I hear. Yeah, it's in the wrong hands at the moment. Let's just do it from here. Okay, you're here in L.A., and you've stopped time, but you're functioning normally, and so you're able to go over to, where would that be? A little south of New York, isn't it? Okay, you're going to North Carolina, but if you stop time, then you're in L.A. and North Carolina at the same time, right? Because you stopped time. And you could continue to do that as long as you had time. So you could go on over to Paris, you could go to the moon, and you've got time stopped, so you're all these places at the same time. You could go everywhere and you could be present because you're everywhere at the same time. Which is very, very much like the Bible describes what God said. Jeremiah 23, verse 23, "Do I not fill heaven and earth, saith the Lord?" And he does. God and God alone is omnipresent. He's everywhere at once because God does not experience the passing of time as we do. He's aware of it. He created it. He can touch it at any point. But he's not restricted by it. He's not limited to it. He's not changing. Change is a function of time. And so this is very difficult to grasp or even talk about, but we need to try to understand what's being said to us here, that God does not experience the passing of time. So this is one of the things that we, you know, every one of us, if we have any goals at all, we're always in a race with death. And the older we get, the more we realize, hey, it's slipping away. I'm going to have to jettison some cargo here because there's other stuff I want to do. And you feel yourself deteriorating, and you know you're not going to get it all done because you're always racing the clock, day and night. But God doesn't experience that. That's why the Jews used to talk about the frightening patience of God, because he doesn't have to be concerned with how much time is going by, unless he's made a promise. He's not slack concerning his promises. But he doesn't have to worry about a change so far as he himself is concerned. Do I not fill heaven and earth? God, in some sense, then, is on the moon, is in Paris, in North Carolina, and here, and everywhere, every corner of the whole wide universe. This is the unknown God that those Athenians were wanting to know about. This is something the Bible states that was not understood as well as we can understand it now until just relatively recently. You know, we think it's so ridiculous that Adam and Eve tried to hide from God, or that Jonah tried to hide from God. Well, it is when we look at what the Bible says about God. They didn't have all that revelation. Jonah should have read the 139th Psalm, I guess. That should have been available to him. Whither shall I go to flee from before thy presence? Though I get to question Jonah a little more than Adam and Eve. But they may well not have known that they couldn't hide from God. There has been progressive revelation that has given us that information. The unknown God is still unknown. That's one of the main points here. He's not physical. He's not an old man in the sky. We talked momentarily ago about going the speed of light and said that that would be impossible to do because you would have a zero in the denominator there, and that in that equation, which I'll not try to go back to, but it would give you a zero there. You know what I mean? V squared over c squared would be zero, and you'd have an undefined equation there. The square root of negative 1, I guess. So it would be an imaginary number. It wouldn't be possible for any physical being to move into another dimension while being still physical, because we're limited in this way. This can well be a part of why no man hath seen God at any time. No man can see God's face and live. There may be a number of reasons for that. One of the reasons may be that you have to be dead to do it. In other words, you have to be in a different dimension in order to do that. When we look at an equation for mass, it's just the same as the other, except we're talking about mass rather than time. And there were similar equations, as some of you know, for length and so on and so forth. I think that these are not challenged. They're deemed to be legitimate equations, ways of understanding the way God has made the universe. In other words, as Einstein put it, thinking God's thoughts after him. The idea here of the mass, and I'll just spend a moment with this, is that mass becomes greater as you approach the speed of light. You get bigger and longer, and you fill more space, so that if you did go the speed of light, you'd fill the universe anyway. And once again, that goes along with what we were saying in Jeremiah 23, do I not fill heaven and earth? The implications of these things are what we're really after. What does eternity mean? I don't believe that you and I can answer that question, because it's dimensionally beyond us. And all these attempts to answer it, like eternity is the amount of time it takes for an ant to move Mount Everest from one seacoast to the other, it misses the point, because we're talking here quantitatively rather than qualitatively. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing his praise than when we first begun. Also misses the point, because we won't be there 10,000 years. It won't be an experience of time. You know, just what it will be, I don't know. But it's not time, at least as defined by us here, because that's going to come to an end. There are all sorts of good reasons for for understanding that our universe had a beginning, it's going to have an end. Time was only measured, of course, by the functions of the heavenly spheres. And when they're gone, then there wouldn't be any way to measure it anyhow. So that's all going to melt with a fervent heat together, sooner or later. Eternity is that situation where time doesn't exist, or if it does, then it's just like being on the surface and it doesn't really affect eternity. Eternity is right now, just as it was before time and is going to be after time. And even these verbs, are the tenses of the verbs correct when we talk about it's going to be? That's why God said in the burning bush, I am, tell them, I am sent you. Because this is the ever-present state of being, as opposed to I have been, or I will be. He is I am. If you believe not that I am, you shall die in your sins. Jesus said, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, when we stop time, there's no more death in the sense of what we experience as physical death. There's no moth and rust don't corrupt in that kingdom, because rust is a function of, is time dependent. We have to be sure that we're careful about the way we even think about that next world, because we get off track very quickly and we get too physical about it. Now, I'm not able to describe to you just exactly what it is and how it is, but I know that it's not physical. Are they real? Of course. Heaven and hell are absolutely real, realer than anything you've ever experienced here. Is God substantial? Absolutely. When we say that God is not physical, we don't mean that he's not substantial or even that he's not corporal. So we have to be careful as we can in defining this and boiling it all down. We have to admit that we just don't understand. He is still, in many ways, the unknown God. He has made it possible for us to know him, but we by no means know all about him or all about what he's like. Now, I met a man one time years and years ago who was actually in the business, and what he was hawking. When you had a loved one in the hospital who was just about to die, this man would run a movie camera above the bed and another one below the bed, and then as the loved one died, you could take these films later and see. But all those sorts of things are based on people's misunderstandings of what these spiritual concepts are all about. I'm not saying that I understand it or that you can't, but I'm saying there are some things we can know about it, and we need to. If you were to stop time, matter would dissolve. And doesn't that remind you of 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10? Right after that verse we just read about time a while ago, we have this about matter, that matter is going to dissolve, that the elements will melt with a fervent heat, that the heavens shall pass away, and that the earth shall be burned up. We will be changed. This mortal will put on immortality. That's deathlessness. We don't know much about the glorified body, but we do know that it's different from the disembodied state, and so there will be a glorified body. That's about all we can say about that, when death is swallowed up in victory. But my point here is that this passage in 2 Peter 3, verse 8, 2 Peter 3, verse 10, this is a very rational description of how this is always going to come, how it's going to come about in the end. Time is not a constant. It's not eternal. It has changed before, and it's going to change again. There is an elasticity to it. And everything that we see around us is subject to change and is just temporary. Now, I have 2 minutes, I think, so I'm going to pause here and see if you have questions or comments. Is that right, 2 minutes? Close enough for California, huh? One time I was over at what? Well, you do. One time I was up in in Santa Barbara, I was there with a guy from London. He was checking his watch every 5 minutes, and he said, "Have you noticed none of these people around here have watches on?" He said, "As long as they know what day it is, that's just fine with them." But I wouldn't have said that if you hadn't have spurred me there. It's not just California. A couple years ago, I was with Tom Dennis in the heart of the Alleghenies, and we were supposed to start our session at 9 o'clock, and at 5 till 9, Tom was looking at the clock. He said, "Well, they better hurry up and get," because it was just me and Tom there. Nobody else there had to. "They better hurry up and get here." And I had to remind him, "Now, Tom, you know that time doesn't mean the same thing here as it does where you and I come from." So it does change a little bit, seriously, from place to place, and that's just fine. No problem. Good. God is light, in him is no darkness at all. Very good, thank you. I think we've come, according to my watch at least. Are those two clocks the same? Some places they set that one that the speaker sees ahead of where the other one is. But I'm glad you don't do that in California. You have 10 minutes. Thank you. 10 minutes? 10 minutes. Be back at 11:22, please.